I'll call the Environment Policy Oversight Committee to order. Thank you all for joining us today. We are going to be having an informational hearing today to talk about the issue of non-ferrous mining and financial assurances. There had been a bill that was put in by Representative Hausman to deal with this issue, and I think it is an important issue that we need to discuss here. We have a number of people that are going to testify. We are going to be giving 20 minutes for the DNR, first of all, to make a presentation about the current rules and regulations. And then we're going to have 20 minutes for those from the mining companies. And we'll have 30 minutes from the MCEA and those who are concerned about the current regulations and to express those concerns. There will be questions asked after each presentation, but I would ask that questions be held until after the presentations are completed. I think that that way we'll make sure everybody gets ample time to testify. And again, we're giving 20 minutes, so there will be time cards that Mr. Kudelka is going to be holding up, just as a reminder of how much time you have when you get down to 5 minutes and down to a minute left. So with that, again, an important issue that we're going to be dealing with here. Those legislators that are here today that are not on the committee, feel free to come to the table and join us and ask questions with us if you so choose at any time. So thank you very much. And Mr. Vadas from the Department of Natural Resources and Jennifer Engstrom are here today. Thank you for joining us to go through the current rules.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. I'm Marty Vadas, and I'm the Director of the Lands and Minerals Division for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. And also here today is Jennifer Engstrom, who is the DNR Mine Land Reclamation Manager. And Mr. Chair, members, if it's all right, what we'd like to do today is give an overview. And I'd like to start that, and I'd like to talk about the Mine Land Reclamation Act that we have here in Minnesota, and talk some about the history that's led us up to the requirements that we have in our mine land reclamation rules. And then I'd like to ask Jennifer to walk through the rules themselves and spend a fair amount of time going over the financial assurance for non-ferrous mining that's provided in the current rules. And so this then is sort of a history of our Mine Land Reclamation Act here in Minnesota. It was originally enacted in 1969, and it authorized the commissioner to develop rules, but it didn't really have a permit associated with it. So that act was amended in 1973 to include requiring a permit, and also financial assurance was added at the time. Peat was added to the materials that require a permit to mine in 1983, and this act was amended in 1990 to allow for non-ferrous rules to be developed. And so then, Mr. Chair, members, this is the Mine Land Reclamation Declaration of Policy that we have in place in Minnesota, and we have added some of the highlights that you see here. And this then gives the policy and the direction to DNR on what's important to consider when developing these rules, and the kinds of things that we need to take into effect. So, for example, we're supposed to control possible adverse environmental impacts of mining, preserve natural resources, and so that's sort of the tone of the policy directing our activities. The next slide shows sort of an overview of what's being reclaimed. And what we're talking about here probably more relates to iron ore, taconite, and also non-ferrous, because this wouldn't really apply to peat mining, which we also have a permit for. But for example, just to give you a sense of it, open pits need to be reclaimed, and there are standards on how that should be done. Also in the rules, underground mines are covered, and reclamation that has to take place to accomplish that. Waste rock and surface rock stockpiles, tailings basins, all buildings and equipment associated with the mining operation. Any infrastructure that's no longer needed for use in the facility And so, for example, if there's a major power line that has some other use, there's provisions where something like that could remain after the operation is closed. The site has to be revegetated if there is disturbed ground, and wetlands need to be restored or reclaimed or replaced. And there's provisions for closure and post-closure maintenance. A little bit of background about the history of what led up to these rules. And I wanted to mention a couple of examples of that. In the mid-1970s, there was a project called the Regional Copper Nickel Study that was funded through the EQB and also the LCMR, about $4.3 million project. And before that, there were a couple of other studies. And I guess the point of this is that these issues have been raised and looked at for a long time, but this regional copper nickel study was study that had the objectives of collecting some baseline data in this area to address things like cumulative effects of mining in the region, provide information for use for policy development, and to analyze some alternatives. And so there are a number of documents that flowed from that, and that gives you some sense of that. And when that study was complete, the Environmental Quality Board asked the Technical Advisory Committee to review the reports and issue some recommendations. And so capture just some of those here. One was to look at the tax policy related to this sort of activity, and that has since been amended. To look at smelter siting. That was sort of a major issue of the time, a potential of a smelter, and that's really not expected to occur in our state with what's being talked about for the current non-ferrous projects. Water quality studies should be continued was another recommendation, and those water quality studies are being continued to this day, looking at really understanding this sulfide mineral business and how it performs here in our state and how to mitigate that. And also a recommendation to develop non-ferrous reclamation rules. And those were developed in 1993. Another example is a project that's called the Non-Ferrous Permit Simulation Project. And this was conducted in the late 1980s, finished in 1990. And the goal was to look in a neutral atmosphere without any pressure of actual development and identify and attempt to resolve environmental issues associated with non-ferrous mining. It was both publicly and privately funded. And you can see on the list there the participants in that study. The objectives were to identify environmental issues associated with that type of mining, take another look at it, identify data needs, look at regulatory shortcomings and duplications, to look at what the potential economic benefits of this mineral development might be, to prepare participants for the permitting process, and to look and see if there were new state policies that needed to be developed to address these issues. The process then was to review existing environmental review and permitting, visit mining operations similar to those that we might expect in Minnesota around the country and in Canada, prepare literature review on environmental effects of non-ferrous mining, and evaluated three hypothetical mining developments, sort of walk those through the environmental review and permitting process. And the results of that was to identify data necessary for environmental review and permitting, identify critical paths for regulatory decision making, actually developed a Gantt chart or flow chart for environmental review and permitting, identify sensitive environmental issues, and financial assurance emerged as a major issue for all the parties involved. And I have to tell you that we found these two exercises enormously useful in developing these rules, just gaining an understanding of aspects of this sort of mining that are really different than what we know from taconite mining in our state, the fact that there are these sulfide minerals associated, and also got a chance to look around the country and learn about the fact that there were indeed examples where there were mines that were developed and companies, for whatever reason, through bankruptcy, did walk away and leave environmental issues to be cleaned up. And so we knew that would be an important part of what we would have to have in our rules in order to prevent the taxpayers of the state, the people, from sort of holding the bag from these sorts of operations, because there were many examples as we looked around the country. And so, Mr. Chairman, members, we now then have three sets of rules that flowed from these reclamation statutes and financial assurance statutes. There are three separate sets of rules, one that govern iron ore and taconite, and they were developed in 1980. Peat mining rules were developed in 1985. And finally, the non-ferrous mining rules were developed in 1993. And so now, Mr. Chair, if it's all right, I'd like to ask Jennifer Engstrom to walk through and help give a picture of how this permit fits in with the other permits that would be required for non-ferrous mining, and then also give some detail on what's in our current rules for non-ferrous.
Ms. Engstrom, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Martin. So the process that went into the development of the actual rules themselves...
Excuse me, if you could identify yourself for the tape as well.
Jennifer Engstrom with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources.
Thank you.
Thank you. Along with, feeding from what Marty described, the investigations and the studies that went on through the 70s and 80s, the process continued as the rules were under development. Again, site visits to operations outside of Minnesota were made, again, to investigate what had gone on in other states, learning from the challenges and successes that had been that had occurred at other places. Discussions at the same time with regulators in both the United States and Canada to get their perspective on things that they would see differently or potentially change. Comments were requested and received of mining and exploration companies to get their point of view. The proposed rules were notified in trade magazines in order to get, again, more input. And the rules were released for public comment as required. And that led to the rules that we have starting in 93. The reclamation is very site-specific. The rules are designed to allow for what is needed on a given operation based on the deposit and the way it would be processed and then the wastes that would be produced. The rules provide direction on how reclamation will be achieved, and it relied on relevant portions of the ferrous rules that we had been working with for 12 years ahead of the non-ferrous rules. And to give a context to the permit to mine is only one of a series of permits that would be required by a non-ferrous operation in the state. The Pollution Control Agency has a suite of permits. This isn't all of them, but it's the significant ones and the ones that would be most common. Major water quality permits, air quality. They have a role in the wetland permitting, storage tanks, if there was a landfill needed on site, potential for hazardous waste, a license that would be required, waste tire storage. The federal government and other state agencies also have roles in such an operation. The Corps of Engineers, Fish and Wildlife, Forest Service, Department of Health. The Minnesota Department of Health has permits and plans that they require. And there may also be local zoning or building permits that would be needed by the operation. Within the DNR, there is also there are other permits, some within the Division of Waters, a water appropriation permit dealing with typically that has to do with dewatering the pits. They obviously fill with water, and that water needs to be moved around. Public waters permits, dam safety. The tailings basins typically have dams that hold the material in, and so those are regulated through permits. Also, an endangered species takings permit or a burning permit might be required. And so in that context, there's also the permit to mine. All of those permits that I described, many of them have their own series of public review and public comment period that goes along with those. The permit to mine does as well. And as Marty described, we do have three sets of rules that we are responsible for under the permit. They're guided by the policy for controlling adverse environmental effects and encouraging good reclamation and mining practices. The wetland replacement plans under the Wetland Conservation Act are included in the permit to mine when it involves, when the wetlands are impacted by mining. A sense of what is in the Ferris permits is listed here. The information about the corporation, the environmental, the settings, the maps, the analysis that was done on the area and the materials, the mining and reclamation, so the planning of what will actually occur, and then the financial assurance is in there. When the non-Ferris rules came into being, it was known that there needed to be a stronger focus than in the Ferris operations for waste characterization and financial assurance. So that's what I'll focus on a little bit next. We've mentioned the 93 that came into being. All of the things that I mentioned that go into the Ferris permit are also in a non-Ferris, and then waste characterization is a focus. I'll just talk briefly about that. At the beginning, the mining company meets with us to discuss what it is they're planning to do and how to best characterize the materials that will be disturbed and become their waste products. The chemistry, mineralogy, petrology, and the leaching characteristics of that material are provided. They're provided at the time leading up to the permit and during the permit application period. They're used to help establish water quality and monitoring standards, and those results and information will be provided during the life of the mine as well, not just at the beginning of it. And the second area of focus in the non-Ferris rules has to do with the financial assurance, so that's where I'll spend the remainder of the time. Here's the purpose, is to perform reclamation activities and any corrective action. If something were to occur that was outside the design and operating criteria of the mine, then that could be would be required in financial assurance as well. The contingency reclamation plan, that's the plan that the mine lays out, and so that if operations were to cease within the first year or any year after that, that becomes the plan to close the facility. It's based on third-party costs, updated annually. If there were corrective action, again, that would follow the same pattern. It must meet the financial assurance amount, and instruments must meet the following criteria: that it needs to be enough money to cover reclamation should the company not complete it themselves. The funds must be available and payable to the commissioner when needed, fully valid, binding, and enforceable, approved by the commissioner, and not dischargeable through bankruptcy. This is the noticing description. So what happens when the permit is deemed complete? It's noticed both in newspaper, EQB monitor, state register. A 30-day comment period commences. If there are written objections, those are dealt with. If not, then the permit can be granted, denied, or the commissioner can request more information. Every year, the mining company turns in an annual report and an operating plan. The annual report describes what happened in the past, and the operating plan describes what's happening in the future. That's then looked at to see if financial assurance needs to be adjusted based on what's coming. No specific type of instrument is mandated. It just simply meets the criteria that I described a minute ago. This is a conceptual idea, just to give folks a sense of what might happen at with the financial assurance amount as time progresses. So it starts at a lower amount typically that first year, because there isn't a lot of disturbance on the ground at the very beginning. As the mine expands, the pits are larger, the stockpiles are larger, the amount of financial assurance would expect to increase over time, and then eventually as the reclamation on site is completed, and there would then be less exposure and the financial assurance amount would decrease. And then it wouldn't be released until any corrective actions, had there been any, had been completed, all reclamation activities were finished, and there were no conditions that necessitated post-closure maintenance. So in summary, we have a series of permits and rules to regulate ferrous, non-ferrous, and peat operations. A long history and a lot of effort, cooperative effort, went into developing both the statute and the rules, and it incorporates important issues and gives the authority to regulate. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Engstrom. Any questions for testifiers? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair, for having this hearing. I think it's real important. Either for Director Vadas or Ms. Engstrom, is there a limit to how little or how much of a financial assurance DNR could request from the mining companies?
Mr. Vadas.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, how that works is that the company needs to supply to us what they plan on doing in the upcoming year as far as moving rock or creating stockpiles or whatever they're doing. The commissioner then can hire a third-party expert to give the commissioner advice on how much it's going to cost to reclaim that if at any point during that year that work stops. And also that third-party expert gives advice on the financial assurance instrument that would be used to cover those costs. And so really the amount of the financial assurance is tied to the amount of disturbance, if you look at it that way. Plus, if there's any need for an ongoing reclamation or treatment, that also would have to be included and covered in the cost that a company would need to post for financial assurance. The whole endeavor is sort of based on the idea that the company is financially responsible for completing their mining and doing the reclamation work, and the financial assurance is in place for if any point during the operation they don't, or they can't, or they won't. So, for example, if the company goes bankrupt, the financial assurance is intended to be used then to move forward to close the site and reclaim it with money that's provided by the company.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Director Vadas, you would not accept a, and I think it was clear so that everybody understands, the commissioner or the third party would determine the amount and the type of financial assurance. Not the mining company is going to tell you, here's a line of credit for $20 million and we're ready to go.
Mr. Vadas.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, we expect that the company will also come in with their view of what the cost is to reclaim that, and that's fine. But the point is then the commissioner will have the ability to hire that third-party expert working for the commissioner to review that and determine on the commissioner's behalf whether or not that's adequate.
Representative McNamara.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. And Director Vadas, so I understand, again, you're not going to accept a line of credit from ABC Mining Company, their corporate line of credit that we guarantee you $20 million. And if they go bankrupt tomorrow, they're gone and we're left holding the bag.
Mr. Chair, Vadas. I think if you look at the criteria, one of them is that it's not dischargeable through bankruptcy. And the mining company themselves certainly could go bankrupt, and so it wouldn't meet that criteria for self-insurance.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Vadas, my other line of question would center around what about the case where we had some folks in the past up on the Iron Range file bankruptcy or sold their company to somebody else and took off and went back to Pennsylvania or Belgium or Germany or India or whatever? What arrangements have you made to make sure that the responsible parties would stay in place and we wouldn't have a parent company change? Or have you not made arrangements for that?
Mr. Vadas.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, the state law and the reclamation rules for Taconite are different than they are for, well, the state rules are different than they are for non-ferrous. And so commissioner can charge, require a bond from a Taconite operation, and there are some in place now, but for Taconite operations in the state, self-assurance is something that is allowed. And so we have had, through the time, and you probably are all aware of it, many examples of where Taconite companies have gone bankrupt, and I personally have probably spent way too much time on bankruptcies through the years, and I think my answer on that is that we have worked to ensure that a site is reclaimed if the company is going away completely. And an example of that would be Butler Taconite that went out of business in 1985. And the companies associated with that no longer wanted to operate that. And that site was completely reclaimed and the watershed was restored. All the buildings were removed. All the foundations were covered with 2 feet of soil and vegetated. And so that site was reclaimed despite the fact that the company involved went bankrupt. There are a number of other examples. Reserve Mining and LTV Steel went bankrupt twice. And worked with other companies that acquired those assets. So those companies are now on the permit to mine and responsible. Examples of that at LTV, Cliffs Natural Resources, now the permit holder there. And at the former reserve operation, the assets were sold to a company named Cypress, and they operated it for a number of years. And that company was purchased a few years ago by Cliffs Natural Resources, and they're now the permit holder and responsible for the reclamation.
Representative McNamara.
My last one, Mr. Chair. So if I understand correctly, Mr. Vadas, you explained a number of situations where in the taconite industry you were able to work through some of the challenges. But isn't it true in your proposals to deal with the non-ferrous, you've got stronger language about parent companies changing or selling or such, that some of the challenges that you worked through in the taconite industry, you've covered yourself up front with the non-ferrous, even making it stronger, their ability to change companies or to leave because of bankruptcy, you still have other means available that you're protecting the citizens of Minnesota?
Mr. Vadas.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, has a totally different set of rules for non-ferrous, and self-assurance is not something that would pass the test for non-ferrous. And the money has to be there ahead of time and not in the form of a corporate guarantee to reclaim the site if that's needed. In the non-ferrous rules, for example, no credit can be given for any ore that's left or any buildings or any equipment. So there's no sort of asset on site that can be used as sort of a down payment or part of the financial assurance. We do not allow that in for non-ferrous. And if there is a change of ownership, the permit to mine would need to be transferred. So we need to have an application to transfer that permit. And before we let go of the financial assurance and the current permit holder, we would need to be satisfied that this other entity that wants to acquire it is capable of doing this type of mining, but then also have financial assurance in place that would replace what we already have. So we would not let go of the permit holder or the financial assurance that we have until we're satisfied that we have an acceptable entity to take over the operation, and they supply the assurance that meets the criteria in the statute that will replace what we already have. Only at that point would we transfer the permit and have that new set of financial assurance in place.
I was just going to ask about, it looks like a fairly lengthy process that was done on this non-ferrous permit simulation from 1987 to 90, so it was a three-year process that you went through, and then promulgating the rules in 1993. But I was just wondering, as far as changes that have occurred since 93, that's a pretty significant period of time. There have been changes, I'm sure, in the technology, changes in the financial world as well. If you could address that, changes that have occurred since 93 in the rules or in financial assurances, that have taken place. Have you been accounting for the changes that have occurred in the mining industry and in the financial world?
Mr. Chair, the rules have not been amended since 1993. And at the time the rules were written, on financial assurance, there were sort of two clear paths forward on how to manage that. One would be to name specific financial instruments in the rules. And the other path would be to set up criteria such as not dischargeable through bankruptcy. And at the time we went through the hearing on these rules, the department made the point that these rules will last as long as the operation holds the permit, which could be decades and decades. an operation, if it's you know, developed for a few years, it operates for 20 or 30 years, and then there's some period of closure and post-closure maintenance. It's not hard to imagine this permit will be in place for 50 years, for example, perhaps longer. And so we were concerned at the time of naming specific financial instruments just because the financial world would likely change through time. And so we wanted these rules to stand the test of time. So instead of naming those specific instruments, we named the criteria. And I think we've seen since 1993 that, in fact, the financial world has changed, that what might have been acceptable in 1993 probably would not be acceptable today as far as a financial instrument. And an example of that might be insurance. At the time, that may have been something that would have been looked on as acceptable, but it's probably not something that we would look at today as meeting the criteria that we have in place. So, long answer, Mr. Chair, but this was a definite, on-purpose decision to go the direction that we did with these rules, and looked at that, and those are the reasons why we did that. And it was really aimed at the fact that this is a long-term endeavor, and that we wanted these to stand the test of time.
Thank you. And Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two quick questions. One's really easy. Both of you mentioned you visited non-Minnesota, non-ferrous mining sites. Where?
Mr. Vadas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Junkie went to Stillwater in Montana. There were some operations in Canada that were visited, and their names escape me at the moment. Went to a mine called the Golden Sunlight Mine in Montana. Went to another one called Montana Tunnels. I think subsequent to that, there have been a number of other visits to some mines in Nevada and Arizona. And also in Ontario, I believe there's a massive sulfide mine that was visited, and also a platinum and palladium mine near Thunder Bay that's been visited. I could supply a list of the ones that we've visited. I could develop that if you'd like that information.
Okay. It's fairly exhaustive. That's what I was trying to get at, was just one or two, or it sounds like you visited a lot. And then just following up on your question, Mr. Chair, you mentioned, you asked a good question, and I guess that's my question too. This legislation that's, you know, been introduced aside, has your department talked about at any time now or recently about promulgating any new rules for this? Or are you still, I mean, it was a good presentation, are you still very satisfied with the rule and the process you have in place? I guess I haven't heard that directly from you other than outlining them. What internally, I mean, have you talked about, reviewed it, said, you know, maybe we within the department should promulgate new rules, or upon your review you said this is probably as good or better than anything else we've seen in all our visits and all the time we've had it on the books?
Mr. Vadas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Junkie, we have done some sort of soul searching on whether or not is what we have adequate, and we've been open to listening to suggestions from people, and people have made suggestions like naming the specific financial instruments. But in reflecting on this past history and what we know about this business, don't believe that we want, well, if I wanted to make a change, I would have done that. I would have asked for the authority if I wanted legislative authority. We believe that what we have in place is adequate to permit the kind of operation that we're talking about, to regulate the reclamation, to have the site restored, and it's our belief that we have what's in place to protect the taxpayers from the potential financial consequences should an operation not perform. So a long answer, Mr. Chair, but you know, if we thought this was inadequate, we would have asked for something different or moved to rule amendments, and we haven't seen the need to do that.
Thank you.
And Mr. Vadas, I guess in discussing the visits outside the state of Minnesota, I know it was done for the development of the rules. Has there been, I would guess that there has been a constant monitoring of what's happening in non-ferrous mines in other parts of the country as time has gone on and we develop and gather more information. And I was wondering, too, as far as these other non-ferrous mines, how similar are they to the, you know, the ores that we have here in Minnesota? And if you could address that.
Mr. Chair, we have made some visits subsequent to that. As a matter of fact, with the PolyMet EIS associated with that, we felt it was important for us to go visit some similar kinds of mines or some mines that we hadn't visited in the past that are dealing with some environmental issues, and also to talk with regulators and see how their plan that they developed is actually performing in practice. And so visited some mines in Ontario and also two in Nevada over the last couple of years to review that. And so we have continued to try to keep up with what's going on around the country. And I forget the second part of your question, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, and I was just wondering what the how similar these other mines are to what we would have here in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, I have to tell you, I'm a geologist and an engineer, and there's no two mines that are exactly alike. And so it just is not possible to make a one-to-one comparison with any other mine anywhere else in the world with any of the deposits that we have here. You can talk about there are similarities in you know, the mineral composition and the amount of sulfur, the amount of metals and that sort of thing. But in fact, each one is a unique mineral deposit. And so you can't take all of what it takes to manage a mine at one place and transfer that exact template onto another one, because nature doesn't work that way. And so, yeah, there's similar kinds of rock and similar kinds of metal content, but they're all different. And even within Minnesota, there are differences between the different deposits that have been identified, both in mineralogy and metal content and so forth.
Okay. Thank you. And Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. As you've been talking about closure and post-closure, I can understand how you can calculate what it would cost to close and post-closure. What you haven't mentioned is, how do you calculate in 20 years after the mine has closed, or even if it hasn't closed, we find problems in our groundwater and the plume is getting bigger and bigger. How do you calculate what kind of assurance you are going to have for that, particularly given that all, as you say, all mines are different?
Mr. Vadas.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I understand the question right. You're asking, you know, what if something shows up after?
Is yes. That,
okay.
And then the question is, how do you calculate what to set aside for that cleanup?
Mr. Vadas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, if you go back to the concept that Jennifer laid out, that it's not one cost for the length of the operation, that it's a yearly review. There will be a yearly review of the disturbance and whatever is needed to reclaim that site even after closure. And so if something were then to show up, whatever that is, during that period of time, that would need to be taken into account in that yearly review, and financial assurance would then have to be in place to deal with that issue.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, that's not quite my question. I understand how you are calculating based on the amount of disturbance. We're finished disturbing. It's done. But 20 years later, we find that our groundwater is being contaminated and the plume is spreading. The question I have is, how do you calculate up front the cost or the money to set aside in assurance? Because that's what's worrying everybody here. How do you calculate that and set it aside, particularly since you're correct and all these are different?
Mr. Vadas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, if I understand it, the question is, you know, what if something none of us thought of or knew about showed up, you know, after closure? And if you remember that a company can't be released from that permit while there still is anything that needs to be done to reclaim the site. And so they're still under permit, even though they're not operating and they're not mining. And so that same procedure of that yearly review of what the exposure is has to be done even after closure, because they still have the permit. And so then with the hypothetical example, if something was analyzed that no one looked for before, or something came up, the company then would need to put the financial assurance up to deal with whatever the mechanism is to treat that or to deal with that issue.
Representative Wagenius.
So you are not upfront thinking that there is a certain probability that something could go wrong and that there would be contamination of the groundwater. We're not setting aside any money for that eventuality up front. We're going to wait to see, and then hopefully this is still a viable firm. They may have a permit, but this is a viable firm that will pay for that contamination.
Mr. Vadas.
Chair, Representative Wagenius, as Jennifer walked through the permit to mine, there's two aspects to the financial assurance. One is in the rules, it's called the contingency reclamation plan, and that's sort of the normal progress of the operation. You know, you understand that you know, you're going to have to, you know, move this material and it'll cost so much to reclaim it. But there also is that provision for the corrective action. And the corrective action is in the rules for the those cases where, despite everyone's best efforts and best planning, something goes wrong or something happens that wasn't accounted for or never dreamed of. And it's my own personal opinion that during a 20 or 30 year mine life or 40 year mine life, it's very, very likely, I might even say a certainty, that something will show up during that operation that no one thought about. Not because they're not smart people, it just, that's how these things in our experience have played out. And so that corrective action financial assurance, that's the purpose of that, is that when those things do happen, that there's a mechanism to increase the financial assurance to address that particular issue that showed up. And there has to then be a direction on how that's to be dealt with, and then the money has to be there to make sure that happens.
Representative Wagenius.
Final question here. My question really is basically, how do you calculate that the amount needed for a corrective action with something going wrong, and when do you put it in the pot? Do you wait until you've seen it, whatever it is, show up, or do we do it right from the get-go?
Mr. Vadas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, I think in the example that you're given, it would be during that yearly review. If something showed up in that year, that's when a corrective action would be added to the financial assurance package.
Representative Wagenius. There,
well, I think that we have come into one of our problems, because we may have finished mining, so we're not setting aside any money anymore, and the thing, whatever it is, shows up 20 years later. So it seems to me that we have to kind of reevaluate, so we really are protecting taxpayers for the corrective action issue, not the closure and post-closure. That seems like you all have a good handle on that, or could, but this corrective action seems very problematic at this point.
Mr. Vadas, if you wanted to respond.
Mr. Chair, I didn't hear a question in there.
No, it's a comment.
And I would guess, of course, the difficulty is you know, if you're going to be requiring any kind of assurance up front for things you don't know might happen, that's the difficulty here. The corrective action, it sounds to me, Mr. Vadas, I guess the concern is not having the resources there at the time the problem is found, and how long would it take to recoup the costs, or is that, yeah, and I don't know if you could address that. If there is a major problem that's found and corrective action is necessary, how long would it take to find the resources necessary to address the problem?
Mr. Chair, the rules provide that if something like what we're talking about shows up, you don't have to wait till the end of the year when you do the review. That the financial assurance and the corrective action can be any time. So it's not tied to the annual review, and there are provisions in the rule to issue fines if a corrective action is issued and it's not complied with, or really any aspect of the reclamation isn't performed according to what the plan is. And I will tell you that during the development of the mine land reclamation rules for non-ferrous, there was an interest by some people of including something that they refer to as a credible accident. And the idea may be something similar to what is being talked about here. And the issue that we had in trying to quantify that is just that. We didn't know how to quantify that.
That was my question.
So the idea that emerged was to financially assure those things that you were aware needed to be accomplished, and then use this corrective action addition to address those things that might or likely will come up during the length of an operation.
Okay. Representative Wagenius.
Fundamentally, we have to devise a system where we, since we know we're going to have a corrective action of some way, we've got to figure out how to start charging that up front and not waiting until we see what has happened, because that mining company may not have the resources anymore. Even though they have the permit, they might not have the resources anymore. And the only person or the only group that will have the resources will be the state taxpayers. So that's the kind of the fundamental issue here, because I think you can do closure and post-closure, but the corrective action leaves a lot of room for getting better, a lot of room.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think if I waited long enough, my questions are going to get answered here. They're kind of going all around it, but my question, Mr. Vadas or Ms. Engstrom, about the corrective action and the interaction, see the contingency plan and the corrective action. I'm looking at the slides that you provided, but the interaction of those with the permit system, the permits that are required. And if you have, well, I'm not quite sure how to address this, but I'll go to the corrective action first. And that's kind of the end product. Would the corrective action include all of the permits over which Minnesota had jurisdiction anyway? I mean, there's some federal permits here, and I'm not going to get into those. But for instance, MPCA permits, would corrective action include those? Do those stay current in a corrective action scenario?
Mr. Vadas. Representative Purcell. And we're focusing on the permit to mine here and what's contained in there for financial assurance, but the authority to set effluent limits and that sort of thing is not in the permit to mine. We don't have that authority. That authority rests with the Pollution Control Agency, and so I think if you add the fact that this is one aspect of what companies would need to do to operate in Minnesota, but they'd also need to comply with the other permit standards that would be out there, like the NPDES, the water discharge permit, and the air discharge permit. And those are issued and managed by the Pollution Control Agency. And so they would be the best ones, I think, to talk to and ask about. those permits and how they operate, because those are in addition to what we have here. This is, as Ms. Engstrom pointed out, one permit.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I'm trying to get at is the interaction. I understand the different agencies, but where, for just a scenario where we're worried about groundwater pollution, mm-hmm. and I assume that the corrective action plan would address groundwater, potential groundwater pollution, or that would be assessed in some way, shape, or form. And I'm also assuming that Minnesota Pollution Control Agency permitting would address that. And is there a coming together of the minds so that everybody, you know, the right hand knows what the left hand's doing, and we get a complete corrective action scenario? That's my concern.
Mr. Vadas.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, I work very closely with the Pollution Control Agency on these mining operations today, and would expect that would continue on in the future, and we talk to each other all the time. And if there are permit exceedances in the PCA permits, and we would certainly know that, and the financial assurance would be adjusted accordingly to whatever the remedy would be to cure that.
And I think we'll do one more question, and then I think we'll move on to the next testifiers. But Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Vadas, just to follow up on Representative Wagenius's questioning, just so I understand again, are you going to accept just the net worth of the mining company potentially as the financial wherewithal? So in other words, a mining company, are you just going to accept their net worth, or is the financial assurance going to come from outside the mining company's net worth, especially in the case of maybe deteriorating net worth over time?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Vadas.
McNamara, the criteria in the financial assurance rule allow us to accept the net worth of the company to fulfill the financial assurance.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you. And I'm not sure I understood. Did you say it would not?
It would not.
So if I can follow up, Mr. Chair, you're not going to accept a mining company's net worth or their value as your financial assurance. You're reaching outside that mining company to assure Minnesota that if the mining company has troubles, which could happen, you're going to have somewhere to go to protect our taxpayers to fix whatever the remedy, the situation that you're going to evaluate at least annually. So you're going to adjust this each year up or down based on the needs you see from sources outside of the mining company to protect our state.
Mr. Vadas.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, what you just described is accurate.
Thank you.
That financial assurance needs to come outside of the assets of that particular mining company.
Well, thank you, Mr. Vadas. And Ms. Engstrom. Next, we will have representatives from the non-ferrous mining industry. We have Mr. Ongaro, Mr. Lehman, Mr. Moore. Mr. Scipione, if you before you testify, if you could just state your name for the tape, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Frank Ongaro with Mining Minnesota. Mining Minnesota's Industrial Trade Association, representing non-ferrous mining companies in Minnesota, committed to responsible development of our natural resources. Up here with me today is Ernest Lehman with Franconia Minerals and several other exploration companies, Joe Scipione with Polymet Mining, and Brad Moore with Bar Engineering. I'll quickly walk through a few points, and these gentlemen can interject and be part of any questions and answers that the committee might have. I want to briefly touch on a few things. Quickly remind everybody of the tremendous opportunity that we have here in the state of Minnesota. Describe our position on the current regulations, and then walk through why all the safeguards are covered by the current financial assurance regulations. We've got a great opportunity in Minnesota. The next generation of mining can bring huge benefits, and the risks are regulated. We've all heard about the Polymet project, 400 permanent jobs, 500 spin-off jobs. The University of Minnesota Duluth took a look at the additional projects and identified investment potential of over $2 billion, totaling over 5,000 potential jobs in non-ferrous mining in the state of Minnesota. And that does not include construction, trades, and labor jobs. That brings that number over 11,000. And Polymet alone will bring in tens of millions of dollars in tax revenue to the state and local units of government each and every year. A huge benefit in this great opportunity. And part of this great opportunity is the regulation of risk. Everything we do every day has risk, and that's why we have regulations on our safety, on our health, and on our environment. We have strong environmental standards in the state of Minnesota, and the industry supports those strong and balanced regulations. That includes the financial assurance that's in place in Minnesota. We believe, we agree with the DNR that we have all the standards and regulations in place in this state to assure our air quality, our water quality, and assure that taxpayers are protected. No additional restrictions or regulations are necessary on financial assurance and non-ferrous mining. Minnesota Rule Chapter 6132 is comprehensive, it's thorough. As you heard from the DNR, it took many years in the making. In 1992, contested case hearings in front of administrative law judges took place, and all parties, all stakeholders, participated in those hearings, and the rules were promulgated, I believe, the next year in 1993. Part of that chapter is the financial assurance requirements, with its purpose to assure that there's a source of funds to be used by the commissioner if the permittee fails to perform. Every company wants to operate in a sound manner in every industry. It's in their financial interest to do so. And we're seeing, with these strong rules in place, that companies are willing and excited about investing in the state of Minnesota. The rules are known, the regulations are known, and the companies are committed to playing by these rules. They understand that this is at-risk capital coming in prior to permits. That investment is all at risk. Polymet, for example, alone has invested over $25 million over the course of about 4 years just in environmental testing and analysis alone. And they're still in the environmental review process. There's certainly no fast track to Minnesota's comprehensive and thorough regulatory process. Minnesota Statute 9349 is a foundation for financial assurance, requiring the commissioner to requiring bond or other securities, and requiring the commissioner to have annual review. That's the basis for this comprehensive, very prescriptive rule that describes what must be looked at throughout financial assurance. All of these aspects must be in place. In Minnesota, we cover all our costs before a permit to mine is issued. We heard how it needs to be bankruptcy proof. We heard about the annual review and adjustment required. We heard how it has to be continually in place. We believe that the state, in its rulemaking process, leaving that flexible, provides the appropriate funding sources will be determined for each individual project each and every given year. There's sufficient and comprehensive public comment and input. The financial assurance takes place in the permit to mine, where it should take place, and the agencies have significant enforcement on the back end for any permit to mine. The rules require that all costs are covered. The rules state that all reclamation, including closure and post-closure, be covered. The rules require that any corrective action, if required, be covered. And the rules require the commissioner to use experienced individuals in financial assurance. Commissioner shall use experienced individuals. And I believe in the case of the DNR and the PolyMet project, they've already put out an RFP or closed an RFP to hire that third-party administrator to work with them on assessing financial assurance for the PolyMet project when it gets to the permit to mine. All the costs are required to be covered. The rules require the financial assurance to be bankruptcy proof. The rules state assurance that funds will not be dischargeable through bankruptcy. They also state that assurance that funds will be fully valid, binding, enforceable under state and federal law. Companies cannot walk away from their responsibility. It must be bankruptcy proof. Annual review is required. The rules state that the permittee shall annually adjust the contingency reclamation cost in the annual report you heard identified. The rules state that the update be based on actual year activity, essentially becoming the plan to close and financially assure the site at any given point in time, every given year in time. The annual review and adjustment is in place. It also requires that the instrument be continuously in place. The rules state financial assurance in the amount equal to the reclamation cost shall be continuously maintained by the permittee. And it states that assurance that the funds will be available and made payable to the commissioner when needed. Continuously in place is covered in financial assurance. In the state of Minnesota, as the DNR described, there's discretion up to the commissioner as to what the appropriate source of funds should be. We believe that this provides the ability of the state to determine the best source of funds to cover that financial requirement. There should not be any restrictions on financial instruments such as surety bonds or irrevocable letters of credit. As you look at other jurisdictions across the country, including the federal government, a list of things available. The federal government, for example, allows surety bonds, allows irrevocable letters of credit. Public comment and input is also comprehensive and thorough. Once a permit to mine application is complete, the notice is published in the EQB and the state register. The permittee is then required 4 consecutive weeks in a row to publish in a periodical the permit to mine. After that last publication requirement, there's an additional 30 days for public comment on the permit to mine. Keeping in mind, this is after public comment on draft EIS, public comment on final EISs, public input and comment on air permits at the PCA, public input and comment on water permits at the PCA. Comprehensive public comment and input is included in the entire process and certainly in the financial assurance in the permit to mine. The financial assurance is required to take place in the permit to mine, and that's where that financial assurance discussion should take place. That's when you have a project that is defined. That's when you can look at the specifics of the thorough comprehensive reclamation standards that the agency referred to, the buffers, the mine waste, the overburden, the pit walls, the storage piles, the tailing basins, the vegetation, the dust suppression, the closure and post-closure maintenance. Those can all be identified and measured at that time. Financial assurance should not be considered to be moved up into the earlier processes in environmental review in the EIS process. The EIS is not a decision document. It outlines impacts and mitigation to those impacts. It does not define a project. Having a financial assurance discussion in the EIS adds cost and delay and is a waste of time and money. Finally, financial assurance enforcement is also thorough and comprehensive. The state has the authority to deny a permit to mine. The state has the authority to suspend a permit to mine. The state has the authority to revoke the permit to mine, and the state has the authority to impose civil penalties. The bottom line, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is that Minnesota is protected. The upfront deposit is already required. There are no loopholes. Our taxpayers are protected, and a company cannot walk away from its responsibility, bankruptcy-proof financial assurance, and being in continuously in place, make sure that the responsibilities will be met. In Minnesota, we're breathing air every day from pollution caused by companies in China and Russia processing these same metals we're talking about, copper, nickel, platinum, palladium, cobalt, gold, using a smelter. We have an opportunity in Minnesota to start doing our part to reduce the global carbon footprint. When PolyMet Mining is a fully operational, fully processing facility, we have the opportunity to, instead of mining in South America, shipping to Asia, processing in a smelter in Asia, shipping those products back here for our consumption, to start doing our part and mine it here, process it here, use it here, and actually reduce the global carbon footprint. We heard about the jobs, but this is about the jobs and the environment. We can have both in Minnesota, and all of us want the same thing. All of us want to leave our air and our water and the quality of both to our kids, our grandkids, and future generations. We have the opportunity to meet the growing demand that we're seeing across this globe, and even domestically, do it with Minnesota jobs, do it with our strict standards, and reduce global carbon emissions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Ongaro. Any questions for the testifiers? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Good information, very interesting. Could you just talk a little bit more about how you would make something like this bankruptcy proof? I mean, that's difficult. How do you do it?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Committee, I don't know which one of us wants to answer that question, but one of the things that is required by the agency is that the commissioner shall consult and employ, essentially, third-party expert that has that expertise in financial instrument, in insurance industry, surety bonds, irrevocable letter of credit, whatever the ultimate case might be. And that might be something that you want to ask the industry or the agency how they plan on going about consulting with the insurance industry for that. Anyone else?
Chairman,
yes, Mr. Scipione.
Ernest Lehman.
Or I'm sorry, Mr. Lehman.
Representing Franconia Minerals. I think the testimony at the Senate hearing last week was quite instructive. One of the testifiers were from the Travelers Insurance Group, for example, and they testified that they could handle surety bonds up to $1 billion. which is far in excess of what any of these projects actually realistically will need. So that's one avenue. Irrevocable letters of credit are guaranteed by the bank that issues them. So the bank usually has some recourse against the operator in this case. But those irrevocable letters of credit become the obligation of usually a major bank. And so those are transferred, in a sense, if they're needed, from the operator to a third party, either a surety company or a bank. So those are two common methods. And as Mr. Ongaro said, the federal government, Bureau of Land Management, for example, accepts either one. My consulting firm has in place a irrevocable letter of credit with the BLM on exploration work in Minnesota on federal lands.
And I guess it ties in with what Representative Anderson was talking about. I understand the importance of the mining industry and what it plays in our economy here in Minnesota, and creating jobs and providing the resources we need for our modern economy. And the fact that the mines of Minnesota fueled the Industrial Revolution, and I do believe that these metals are going to be needed for the new technologies that we have today, the new machines that we have today, our computers, and so on. So they're going to be gotten somewhere, and that it would be better to do it here where we can create jobs, and I hope do it more in an environmentally friendly way. Rather than having it done someplace else where they don't have the type of environmental concerns or environmental regulations that we do. But there is this concern about the financial assurances that, taxpayers or the communities aren't left holding the bag for costs or environmental degradation. And in the case, it seems to me that there's some concern yet about the corrective action, because at that point you no longer have the financial assurances up front. You're trying to recoup it after the fact. In that case, you know, if there's a bankruptcy, as Representative Anderson said, it would be much more difficult to cover those costs. Where would you get that? And if the company is still in existence and doing well, it's still probably going to be a little more difficult because, again, you're getting it after the fact. Could it be done through civil penalties? How far can they go as far as assessing fines, for instance? And maybe some of these questions should be directed, again, at the DNR. I don't know if Mr. Vadas would want to address any of this, if he's still in the audience. So if you'd step forward, and certainly you can address it as well from the mining companies, if you've got any, and maybe you can tell me if there's been any examples of corrective actions that have taken place and how that was done.
Mr. Chair, again, Marty Vadas from DNR. I'm sorry, the question, if you could repeat that.
Sure,
please.
Sure. And I was wondering, as far as corrective actions are concerned, it's more difficult, I was saying, to collect the costs or the funds necessary to cover the costs because it's after the fact, especially if there's a bankruptcy that occurs. And I was wondering what would happen in that case, first of all. If there's a bankruptcy after there's a problem that's been found and the money or the funds aren't currently there to cover the costs, so you have to recoup the costs after the fact, how would that be accomplished?
Mr. Chair, are we talking about the reclamation plan, or are we talking about
a problem that emerges
during the
later
operation or after the operation?
After the operation is closed, and then there's a problem that emerges that was unforeseen. Therefore, there wouldn't be, I don't think there's a down payment that's there waiting. It would have to be something that's recouped after the fact.
If you think of the practical side of this, if there is a problem that is going to show up that wasn't anticipated during the planning, it's most likely that it's going to show up during the operation while a company is still there and operating. and I think Representative Wagenius brought up an example of, well, you know, what if something shows up in the groundwater, you know, some years after closure and so forth. And all I can tell you on that is that the rules are designed to address that through this corrective action, and the money has to be in place for the contingency plan, and then the commissioner then, through the rules, would require that additional financial assurance be put up to cover that corrective action. And I think in your example, if, and it's a hypothetical again, let's say, for example, 20 years after closure, that company no longer exists. They still would have to have maintained the financial assurance necessary for the closure, and the company is fully financially responsible to make the corrections that are needed, and then the commissioner would pursue getting financial assurance to cover the fact that they don't. So if the scenario that we're talking about is that a company has operated, they've closed, it's 20 years after, the financial assurance is in place to cover the known reclamation costs, and then there's some additional issues that show up and the company no longer exists, that would be an issue.
Okay.
Should those circumstances fall into place like that, then that would be an issue.
Okay. And let's see, we have Representative Sterner.
Thank you, Chair Eakin. I just had some questions just in general about operations of non-ferrous mining, but I'm just wondering if you could tell me how many non-ferrous mining companies have a presence or interest in Minnesota to date?
Mr. Lehman.
Chairman, Representative, there are five companies. Five companies that are active in the copper nickel area: Polymet, Kennecott, which is division of Rio Tinto, which has a project in Aiken County; Franconia Minerals, which is in the Duluth complex, we're about 10 miles north of Polymet with our Birch Lake deposit. We have two other deposits, but we're looking at developing Birch Lake. Duluth Metals, who are next to one of our other deposits and are north of us about 4 miles from our Birch Lake property. Tech Corporation, which has the old AMAX property, which was subject to some of the copper nickel, generic copper nickel study that was done 1974 to 79, and then a private company called Encampment Minerals, which is active, and one or two smaller entities. So you really have, in the copper nickel area, I would say at this point, five really active companies, all of whom are publicly traded companies.
Okay. Representative Sterner.
Okay. And I was just wondering, you know, we're hearing how risky this is, but have there been, in the United States, mines, are there some mines that have went without a violation or to date, in the United States, and if so, where are those locations?
Well, Mr. Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, if you look back far enough, and I have an ability to look back pretty far, I've spent 60 years in this industry. Yes, there were many things that would now be considered violations. When I first went in the industry shortly after World War II, you know, I feel I was part of a new age, a new generation, the younger outlook, because we were concerned with the environment. And before that, there really had not been much concern with the environment. So many of the examples that are cited are operations that are very old. and they obviously have problems. They're mostly in the western U.S. There have been some in the southeast. There's no denying that. But this is a new generation, and I think many of us are part of that new generation. And we are concerned about the environment. I've been in Minnesota only 50 years, but my friends on either side of me are second and third generation Iron Rangers. You know, we all are concerned about what goes on and how we do things. It's a different world.
Okay, thank you.
And Representative Gardner.
I'll pass the time, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Angaro, I believe it is. I hope I pronounced your name correctly. I was looking at the slide you had here with the global carbon footprint, and I understand what you're saying about how you'd like to try to reduce the cost or the cost of attributed to carbon by doing more manufacturing here. But I also find it to be a very convenient argument to make, specifically when you say, you know, it benefits you, but when you have power companies or utilities in the state of Minnesota saying that we need to protect this industry so we can't do renewable energy or let alone do any type of community energy in Minnesota because it might cost a little bit more, I do see that as maybe not a wholesome argument. It is frustrating to me. And I would hope that you could respond to that, because if you're going to use the argument that we need to reduce our carbon footprint, then I think it's also the onus is on you to be embracing Minnesota renewable energy, community-owned energy in Minnesota, the renewable energy that we feel we need to get to, and not have basically the utilities that are supplying your industries saying that we can't afford to do renewable energy. I do find that to be frustrating.
Mr. Angaro.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Falk, clearly from the non-ferrous mining industry standpoint specifically, these projects, doing what they plan to do, will help bring down to some degree. There will be a start in helping reduce the global carbon footprint. The energy use and consumption in the utility industry and the cost of generation for an individual company or the industry as a whole is broader than I think what we can speak to tonight. But we're looking at an opportunity from this industry to make a start in that direction.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is for Mr. Angaro or Mr. Lehman or any one of the four. I'm just curious. There's been some real problems with a few mines out west, specifically, I think, in South Dakota. There was the Gilt Edge mine in South Dakota, the Landusky mine in Montana, and I believe there's at least one other one in Montana where the local taxpayers, the state, have ended up footing the bill for probably some poor planning, I would say, both on the part of the mine and on the state agency. How is our situation here today any different than those states? What kind of guarantee do we have for the taxpayers of Minnesota that you're not going to do what those states did?
And just to make sure before you testify that everyone speaks into the mic so that it picks it up on the tape. But, Mr. Moore?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, I'm Brad Moore with Barr Engineering. Yeah, the Gilt Edge mine in South Dakota, there were some very things that were very different. First of all, it was a heap leach cyanide operation, and that's where you actually take the waste, the ore, the rock, pile it up, and then you treat it with chemicals to release the metals. And those metals at the bottom of the pile are then collected. The difference in that mine, first of all, is that's a process that's not being proposed by PolyMet. Instead, the metals will be processed in a enclosed autoclaves. In addition, for that particular mine, they actually discharged some of the waste directly into the streams. And so their discharges went right into the environment. And the process that we're proposing, that's not the case. It goes into a tailings basin or into residue cells. So there's a variety of things that are different. And then finally, the financial assurance mechanisms in Minnesota in place are much different when that mine actually began in the 1930s and earlier. So that's a short answer.
Yep. Representative McNamara.
And a follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Moore. What about the examples in Montana? Are you familiar with any of those or the challenges out there or how we've learned from that, I'm assuming, or hopefully we have?
Mr. Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, I am somewhat familiar with Zortman. Zortman, again, there was no real financial assurance requirement in Montana at the time that was created. The company did go bankrupt, which was the problem, so there was no money to do the reclamation. The bankruptcy court or the bankruptcy person and trustee on Zortman, I mean, there has been reclamation done. There has been some state funding on two other mines owned by the same company. In fact, a friend of mine was the bankruptcy trustee, and those were reclaimed, I think, without any issue with the state of Montana. No contribution from the state of Montana. I'm not sure what the second one you're referring to in Montana is, but Montana has really not had financial assurance provisions unless they've put them in recently.
Representative McNamara.
Just a final follow-up, and maybe it's best suited for Mr. Lehman. In your, I believe you said 60 years, how do the financial assurances that you've been dealing with the DNR in Minnesota compare to the other states where you've been involved?
Well, Mr. Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, the financial, in the case of Franconia Minerals, when we get to the mining permit stage, which we hope to do sometime in the next several years, we hope to actually start the permitting stage probably by the end of this year. That's when we will deal with financial assurance. In doing work on federal minerals in Minnesota, we have had to put up an irrevocable letter of credit as financial assurance for that work. So that's my experience with the situation in Minnesota. Until you get to the permit to mine, there is no financial assurance requirement.
Okay. Representative McNamara. Well,
maybe I could just clarify for any one of the testifiers. How does what we're expecting you folks to put up compared to what Montana did or South Dakota did or are doing today? Are our financial assurances only half as good as the other states, or are they as good? Are they better? I want to put more pressure on you guys to make sure you don't ditch us, is what my deal is. And I'm wondering, are we putting more pressure on you to be responsible for what you're going to do?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. McNamara, I think, yes, you are already putting a lot more pressure. I think the DNR is putting a lot more pressure on the operators here. The other state that I'm familiar somewhat with financial assurance on is Nevada. And Nevada has mostly federal land, so most of its surety bonds and letters of credit and maybe some other mechanisms acceptable to the Bureau of Land Management. Nevada also has what they call a bond pool where the industry contributes to that pool, and that's administered by the state. But Nevada is, 75% or 80% federal land, so that's who you deal with in Nevada.
Thanks. And Mr. Ongaro.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, Regardless of what other jurisdictions allow for types of instruments for financial assurance, Minnesota's rules are prescriptive so that they are totally comprehensive as they determine what the overall cost that will have to be covered for the reclamation and for any corrective action will be. Then, and only then, will that level be determined, and then the type of instrument to cover that be discussed. And we've had some discussion about sins of the past and problems in other states and in operations that are perfect examples of what PolyMet's not going to be doing, as Mr. Moore mentioned, the heat bleaching in South Dakota. And we keep talking about the fear of this worst case scenario, and I think it's important to describe all the engineering, hydrometallurgical testing, and waste characterization and everything that goes into these operations, these plans, before they become operations, so that the chances of anything happening become very, very minimal. PolyMet, for example, has over 500,000 analyses of their wastewater characterization alone. And they've looked at, with their sulfur content, all the different amounts of waste, and 97% of their waste rock over the course of 4 years of testing is within streamwater range, pH neutral. And a small percentage that has some acidity is somewhere between milk or beer. And that's going to be addressed with mitigation specifically for that different characterization to avoid those worst case scenarios. So there's a lot of things that go into the bar engineering types on the front end to address those waste characterizations, so those risks are identified and addressed. Does that answer that?
Thank you. And we have two more questions, and then I think we'll move on to the other testifiers. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not going to ask Mr. Vedas to come back up, but I just want to revisit and the point that you made there, and thank you for doing that. We got into the contingency plan and corrective action, and where I was talking about earlier, and I do believe that there's a hole there. When we look long term, and I'm going to say at the same time, I'm also the belief that we could do this and do it right in Minnesota, that this could be a valuable asset. But just looking at the draft EIS comments that US EPA put forward, and it says long term post closure treatment will be necessary to protect water quality. Therefore, EPA believes financial assurance information should have been included in the draft environmental impact statement. The sooner we plan, the less apt we are to make mistakes. And I would argue if we had information in front of us today that was part of that draft EIS, we probably wouldn't have to be sitting here having a lot of this discussion, because we would know. I just think it's prudent to plan ahead, and we know we've got some issues. And I look forward to hearing the rest of the testimony. Thanks.
Okay. Do you want to testify? Mr. Moore.
Mr. Chair, just a comment on Representative Purcell's what you said. One of the challenges in developing this EIS, it's a state and federal EIS, and typically in the state side of the EIS, the financial assurance is handled in the permit to mine, and in a number of federal EISs, we can see it in the actual EIS document. So one of the issues as a result of the EPA comment letter is the lead agencies, the Corps of Engineers and the DNR, need to set a course on that particular issue so that the final EIS meets federal standards and also meets the state standards. And those agencies are conferring in terms of, on that comment letter, how to address it in terms of some of the different ways the state addresses issues in the federal government. So. To address the very question you have raised.
And is there problems with in the EIS process? It hasn't been narrowed down to what exactly, I guess, the process is going to be, what kind of mining process is going to be put into place. I was just wondering if that makes it difficult to establish financial assurances, because there's a number of different contingencies that haven't been settled on yet. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct, and I think when you look at the various comment letters coming from many, it reflected the fact that the draft EIS did not have a preferred alternative, that is, a project, one project ready to go. And as a consequence, I would anticipate that a final EIS would have that. And EPA comments and others have reflected the concern to say what that final project will look like. The decision to not have a preferred alternative in the draft EIS was a decision by the lead agencies.
Okay. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief, but my point is that we know we've got long-term monitoring costs, long-term, decades, many decades perhaps. Let's plan for it, and we can plan for it early on as opposed to having to wait for a permit process. That's my only point. We can do it either way, but the sooner we plan, the better we are.
And Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ungaro or Mr. Moore, I listened to the earlier testimony and talks about rules that were put together in 1993, and I was thinking about the wetland portion of this whole discussion, that we've had so many changes to state wetland law and federal wetland law, federal wetland court decisions, overlapping jurisdictions. And then when I read the Interior letter and the EPA letter, they spend quite a bit of time on wetland permitting. And there's not a lot of area in the area where you could mitigate by recreating, because it's in the over 80% counties. So, you know, we've had some discussion earlier about other states which are drier states. And probably the issue here that comes into question is our amount of water that's in these sites and wetlands being on the sites. So my question for you is, how do you navigate the existing state and federal wetland laws to meet their goals and requirements right now as you develop?
Mr. Moore.
Mr. Chair, Representative. It is quite a challenge to navigate those. As you, those of you, for example, that read the EPA letter, they came up with a designation that typically we do not see in terms of wetlands of national significance. As a consequence, the lead agencies now, that would be the Corps of Engineers and EPA, have to work out what that means to them, and as a consequence, what that means to those of us that are going through the process. It's an iterative process, and when you develop an EIS, data comes in, lead agencies look at it and say, this is adequate, this is not. You go back, the project proposer comes up with another proposal or changes it. So the short answer to your question is, it's an arduous process, and even the comment letters coming in, as a consequence, what we'll need to do with respect to wetland mitigation and replacement will inevitably change from the draft EIS. Did that get your question? Very rigorous.
Okay. And Mr. Ungaro, and if you could speak into the mic, please.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, just in follow-up to that, in putting the issues of the last couple questions into context, the EPA letter was a comment from a federal agency that is not a participating agency in the EIS. Its comments will be taken into consideration by the Corps of Engineers and the DNR. That's where it should take place. That's how the process is supposed to work. And those issues either will have to be addressed, are being addressed, will have to be looked at or disagreed upon, and ultimately, before a final EIS comes out, the project proposer, PolyMet, will have to show that they're addressing wetland issues, they're addressing water treatment issues, and everything else before something moves forward to permitting. That's where it should take place. That's why it's called a draft EIS. It's not supposed to be final yet.
Final question. Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I believe this would be for Mr. Ongaro. And it's perhaps not so much a question as a statement, but you know, I'm concerned that often Minnesota has regulations that are, and standards that are stricter, certainly than the federal government in many cases, and also certainly than other states. And I'm concerned for kind of the, maybe the parallel with the No Child Left Behind. You know, we're federally that we're basing all of this or many education standards on what's good for the rest of the country, and what's good enough for them is supposed to be good enough for us. Well, I think I hear a lot from people in Minnesota saying that that isn't good enough for us, and I'm concerned that that same situation will be the case or could be the case as well with regard to non-ferrous mining. And, you know, I just don't have the highest level of faith in some of the federal government standards, and I want to make sure that, you know, the state of Minnesota is left whole. And so I just have concerns that, as Mr. Representative McNamara also brought up with regard to financial assurance, but my concerns are with many of the environmental issues that, you know, I just because another state or the federal government has a certain degree of regulation or standard, I'm not sure that that necessarily really is where the state of Minnesota wants to go. So that's my concern.
And Mr. Scipione, if you could state your name for the record, please.
Joe Scipione from Polymet Mining. I'm the President and Chief Executive Officer, Chairman and Representative. This is about the longest I've ever sat quiet, I guess. I think what a lot of this boils down to is, you know, just I'm going to get at your question real quick here, but is risk management, right? And I think in a case here is that how do you minimize the risk so that, you know, we don't have something horrible happening 20 years after closure or some other time, right? I mean, that's a disaster. That's a disaster for everybody. That's a disaster for the state. It's a disaster for Polymet and our investors. I can tell you right now, part of my job is to attract, you know, about $600 million of new money into Minnesota to create new jobs and an industry that works right. And I can tell you right now that investors are not interested in investing in an operation that is going to leave legacy costs. So the question comes is, how do you prevent that from happening? And I think there's several ways that are happening all at once here. One is a very, very thorough EIS process. We start out, just to give you a real brief summary here, is we start out with a project that you propose, and then you look at different alternatives that could be done to it. You evaluate those, and we spent $25 million in over 4 years evaluating all these different alternatives and possibilities and how can you do this better. And some of these answers you don't know when you first propose exactly what you're going to do. Where are you going to put this stockpile, say, or how are you going to process the minerals exactly? What are you going to do exactly on the tailings basin? These types of things, right? So you study all these things, and you come back with different results, and you see how it meets it, or it maybe doesn't meet it. And if it doesn't meet it, you go back on its iterative process and change it so that it will meet all of the standards, okay? So you have this thing, and one of the questions with the EIS, why wouldn't you do financial assurance in the EIS, is that you have all these different alternatives, and until you settle down on what is the best alternatives here for the mine, for the plant, for the tailings basin, you can't really get a good number on financial assurance, okay? Because you have all these different things that you're studying, and the cost would be quite prohibitive, and it'd actually be quite wasteful because you're spending all this money studying alternatives that you've learned over 4 years that you're not going to use. They're not even going to be there. But according to the EIS process, you would have to study and spend all kinds, maybe millions of dollars studying all of these things and maybe years in time to figure out what the costs of these things would be and what the financial assurance would be for things that you're not even going to do. So it really doesn't make a lot of sense from a company standpoint, and I don't think for the taxpayers of Minnesota, and especially for the people that are sitting there waiting for jobs, okay? To sit there and needlessly spend years maybe trying to figure out alternatives for financial assurance on alternatives that are never going to happen. Okay, so just a comment on maybe a couple of questions that have happened. So the right time to do it is what the state of Minnesota has in laws, and that is wait till the EIS process is finished, which it's not, okay? Then find your best alternative in it, and then from that, that goes into the permitting phase, and that's when you establish the financial assurance. So that makes all the sense in the world, and that makes sense to investors. The second point is that the best way to minimize your risk is to do extensive testing, modeling, and engineering to prevent the problem. We're fortunate here in Minnesota that we have 50 to 100 years of bad examples elsewhere, and a lot of these examples don't even apply. We don't have smelters. We don't have heap leach things. We're a low, very low sulfide deposit compared to high concentrated sulfide deposits. So that's one of the fortunate things that we're blessed with, is our ore deposit, besides being in a mining zone, is a very low sulfide deposit, which helps immensely in actually the risk of this whole thing, all right? But furthermore, what you do is you spend literally millions of dollars hiring the best experts in the world. And these are experts that study, they're experts on stockpile construction, on water collection, experts on geochemistry, geophysics, you name it, right down the line. All these water experts, these are people that have spent their lives doing this. Okay, I mean 20, 30, 40 years. This is what they do for a living, air modeling. You hire those, which is what we've done, supply all the information, looking at all these alternatives, and then in the end, you come up with the best alternative to minimize the risk and to build in all of the precautions and the alternatives that will do just that. Then the fourth, and quite frankly, in our project here, we have over $100 million that is going to be invested in just those things to be able to make sure that up front you're doing it right. Because the real answer to pollution, the real answer to, to minimize pollution is to build in the right process, to build in the right safeguards, to recognize what it is that could go wrong and prevent it before it happens. Not react to it later on. Investors aren't interested in reacting to things later on because that just leads to legacy costs, and that leads to uncertainty with financial assurance and all kinds of uncertainties, and you can't attract money into Minnesota under those circumstances. Okay, I can just tell you that right now. So PolyMet has had the philosophy and is doing it. We're spending the money up front on this extensive EIS with lots of alternatives, lots of iterations of how to do this best, pick out the best alternatives. The public has all the opportunity in the world to comment on this. All of the agencies do. The EPA, that acts as an independent auditor in this function, has that ability and has done that. So you put all those things together, and now they're figuring out, okay, well, what's the best way of finishing this off? Which are the alternatives that we should do? How do we make sure this works, and how do we make sure it works right from the beginning so you minimize this risk? Then, beyond that, you still have the financial assurance thing. And, of course, if you've done your homework here, you've done the right things so that your risks are low to begin with, but just in case, the state of Minnesota has a variety of alternatives that they can choose from with financial assurance. Because it's very likely that one shoe doesn't fit everybody. For instance, if you have a plant that you know, it's got a foundation, it's got beams, and it's got columns and all that, that's pretty predictable as to what you have, right? And that might take one kind of financial assurance that's pretty well known how you could do it. You know, maybe that's a cash thing or something like that.
And if I could ask you to wrap it up.
Yep, I'm on the last point here. The other thing is that there are maybe some things, is that how do you prevent, or how do you plan for maybe something like, well, what if Halley's Comet takes a left turn 20 years from now and comes toward Earth? Right? You know, it's kind of the same thing. What about this totally unexpected, after all the engineering, all of everything that everybody did, the best minds in the world, all the best planning, building in everything, what if it's still wrong, right? And you have a Halley's Comet turn toward Earth here, or that kind of event. that's where you have different types of financial assurance that could be used for different aspects like that. Maybe that's an application for a surety bond. Maybe that's an application for insurance, a good application for insurance, maybe. I mean, that's what we do with our cars. That's what we do with other segments of the in our lives. Low likelihood of happening, but you want to have something just in case, right? So I think there's a lot that's gone into this whole process and a lot that still has to be done. And I think it's a very good process, and I think we're doing the right things to make sure that this is done right for the investors, that it's can be done economically, that can be done in the right way for the state, and you don't leave a legacy cost. I'm a third generation miner up there. The last thing I want to do is leave a problem for my son and my grandson that live up in there. I can tell you that right now. So, okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think we'll move on to the next testifiers so that they'll have their time here. Welcome to our committee, Representative Hausman, and welcome also to Mr. Scott Strand and Mr. Bob Tamman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I should just say the title of our little section says Environmental Organizations with Concerns. I will tell you that many of the people sitting in the audience will say it is citizens with concerns. Many of those citizens who live in northern Minnesota and are going to be the closest to potential impacts. There is so much to say. We have put some handouts in your packet. I'm going to hand, if there's a page, I'll hand out one more. This is from Bruce Johnson, environmental scientist, and I was going to save it till later, but one of the things that was just referenced was the low sulfide percentage that mining companies refer to, and this is a gentleman who listened to the testimony in the Senate and made some clarifying statements about some of those claims, and I think I'll just add that. Representative McNamara isn't here anymore. There you are. I was going to say to him that actually we aren't putting as much pressure on the industry as Wisconsin, because Wisconsin law says do it somewhere else first. Prove to us that it worked somewhere else. And our bills in the last few years, they were slightly different each year, said do it right, but if you fail, we want to protect the taxpayers.
Okay.
Because of course members, 100% of the companies say they are not going to leave any damage. But in this case, with this new type of mining, most were wrong. And that's why we have this issue before you. We have many people here who would like to testify, but we're going to limit ourselves to two gentlemen so that they have sufficient time to sort of make the broad argument. And if there is time, I may make some concluding comments, but I'll save all the time.
Okay. Just thought I'd mention that you already did have the handout was already in the packet, just in case you were wondering. But so, Mr. Strand, welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Scott Strand. I'm the new executive director at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, the MCEA. Although I'm new to the MCEA, I do have some history with mining issues and the issues that are now before this committee. As some of the members of the committee know, I was a longtime member of the State Attorney General's office, and I represented the Department of Natural Resources and its Mineral Division for several years. My work with the DNR started back in the mid-1980s with the first wave of mining company bankruptcies, with the reserve mining case, with the first LTV bankruptcy case. And I watched as those bankruptcies put lots of people out of work, cost hundreds of early retirees their health insurance, and put the environment up in the Iron Range Lake Superior area at considerable risk. Back then, with the reserve case alone, the taxpayers faced an environmental cleanup liability exceeding $100 million, and there was not a dime in place to pay for any of those costs. As Mr. Vadas explained, the only thing that saved the day back then was the fact that a buyer showed up for reserve and an LTV that was able to shed all of its pension obligations to its workers was able to reopen the plant. So we dodged a bullet back then, but there was we did learn from that experience. While those bankruptcy cases were going on was exactly the same time that the non-ferrous reclamation rules were being developed at the DNR. And I believe it was the experience with those bankruptcy cases that drove the establishment of financial assurance requirements which are in the current DNR rules. I think the DNR deserves considerable praise for pushing that requirement through the rules back in the early 1990s. But the question today is the question that the chair raised, I think, at the beginning of this hearing, which is, have we learned something from the last 17, 18 years that should inform our judgment today about how financial assurance needs to work in practice? Mr. Chairman, it's of course vitally important to put these kinds of issues in the context of the information we have today. So I want to just lay out some of what I think are really some of the key contextual facts for this discussion. Fact number one, hard rock mining, the kind of mining we're talking about, was at the time that the rules were adopted the number one source of hazardous toxic waste releases in the country. In 2009, 17 years later, hard rock mining is the number one source of toxic waste releases in the country. Not the top 10, not the top 5, number one, and it's been number one throughout the period that the toxic release inventory has been in place. The EPA has identified it as the number one priority for establishing new financial assurance requirements at the federal level under the federal Superfund law, and we expect that we'll see those rules sometime in 2011. Fact number two, this is about sulfide mining. When you expose sulfide ores to air and to water, you get sulfuric acid, what's called acid mine drainage, AMD, which also contributes to the leaching of heavy metals, and you also get what's called sulfate loading of the surrounding waters. We've known and studied about AMD a long time, but certainly back in the early 1990s, we did not have the understanding that we have today about the effect of additional sulfates in our water. And the fact that when you take sulfates and certain bacteria and slow-moving waters, you have a recipe for what's called mercury methylation, which is the process where we take mercury that's existing in the environment today and we convert it chemically to the form that bioaccumulates in the fish and creates a human health hazard. So whether the acid is controlled or not, the sulfate loading is an issue that we've learned about since the early 1990s, and it's a particular concern with these mining operations now in northeastern Minnesota. Fact number three, no one has yet invented an environmentally benign open pit strip mine. The Polymet project alone will tear up several thousand acres of land in an area that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has already designated as critical habitat for endangered species. The Polymet project alone will also be the cause of one of the single largest destruction of protected wetlands in Minnesota history, a wetland system that the U.S. EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, has designated as an aquatic resource of national importance. Fact number four. There have rarely, if ever, been legitimate walkaway scenarios for sulfide mines. Water pollution problems from sulfide mines can and do arise years after a mine closes, after the mining company is gone. Even the Polymet environmental impact statement acknowledges that there will likely be a need for long-term, maybe perpetual, water treatment if the site there is going to meet even current water quality requirements. Asking for additional financial assurance from a company that no longer has revenues, has no prospect for revenues, and probably does not exist anymore is not going to solve that problem. This is an issue that has to be addressed up front. Fact number five, despite better financial assurance regulations in the Western United States and in fact around the world in the last 20 years, mining companies have continued to walk away from their environmental obligations. the logic, of course, is inescapable. When a mine closes, there is a powerful incentive for the company to do everything it can to avoid the costs of environmental cleanup. The revenues are gone. There is nothing but cost in the future, and investors are not interested in companies with only costs on the horizon. Legacy costs and avoiding them to the extent that you possibly can is a priority for any company that's in that situation. Fact number six, financial guarantees from parent corporations, from insurance companies, from banks are simply not as secure as we once thought they were. We've all seen it in the last couple of years. Corporations with rock solid balance sheets on Monday can be bankrupt on Tuesday. Bank and insurer, bank and insurance company refusals to pay contractual obligations have become commonplace. Taxpayer-funded bailouts to solve those problems at an enormity we've never before contemplated have now saddled us with obligations that will take generations to pay. Mr. Chairman, I run through those basic facts just to underline the critical importance of getting financial assurance right and how vital it is that we learn the lessons of the last 15, 20 years since the DNR's rules were adopted. Financial assurance, the idea of a damage deposit up front, does not solve all the environmental problems, but it can help get the incentives right. If an adequate financial assurance package is in place, the mining companies no longer have the incentive to cut and run when the mine is no longer sufficiently profitable, but instead they have the incentive to stay in place, keep the jobs in place, keep people working now on reclamation, cleanup, and water treatment because they have the opportunity to get the financial assurance money they previously posted back. So in other words, doing what's right for the environment becomes a source of revenue, not just a deadweight cost that it's in the interest of the shareholders to avoid. Now, I think as a result of all of that, mining regulators, throughout the United States, at the state level, federal level, even throughout the world, today in most cases, insist on financial assurance as a precondition for a permit to mine. Yet, time after time, we've seen seemingly tough financial assurance rules and requirements, along with mining regulators acting in good faith, come up short, fail to protect the environment, fail to protect the taxpayers. What has happened? Basically two problems, Mr. Chairman. Number one, the financial assurance amounts have been too low. Number two, the agencies have accepted forms of financial assurance that have proven not to be secure. Let me talk briefly about the amounts. The history of financial assurance in the mining industry is not a good one. In your packets, I think there are materials with several examples of mines out west where the taxpayers have been stuck with cleanup problems even after, even with financial assurance rules in place. Maybe the best example is the Summitville mine in Colorado. That mine went bankrupt. EPA and the state of Colorado were able to recover, I think, about $28 million in the bankruptcy. There was a financial assurance package in place for $4.5 million. The cost to the state of Colorado and the EPA so far is over $200 million, and the meter's still running. That's an example of even with financial assurance rules in place, it hasn't proven up to the job. Now, why has that happened? The problem is water quality issues. The problem is the need for long-term water quality treatment with sulfide mining. A recent survey done of several environmental impact statements done on sulfide mining projects shows that the predictions of water quality problems in the long term have been too low nearly every time. Mining companies, mining regulators have consistently underestimated the size of the long-term water quality problem. And the mining permits and the financial assurance packages that have been put in place have consistently failed to provide much, if anything, in the way of financial resources to address those long-term water quality problems. EPA Region 10 in Seattle, which includes Alaska, Idaho, a number of big mining states, last year did a survey of all the large mines within their jurisdiction, and they found out that while most of the financial assurance requirements and regulations have done a decent job of estimating the cost and providing for the cost of kind of classic reclamation, earthwork, filling in mine pits, tearing down buildings and roads, revegetating. But they've consistently failed to set aside really any money to cover long-term water treatment costs, even though covering long-term water treatment costs is often an express requirement of the rules. Minnesota's rules are a little bit different because they don't mention long-term water treatment costs at all. The phrase that's used in Minnesota is post-closure maintenance. We hope that will include the treating long-term, addressing long-term water quality program requirements, but we don't have that requirement in our Minnesota law. So what's needed, really, I think, is this, to make it work under our current rules. Water treatment needs need to be evaluated under a number of different scenarios. Certainly under closure as planned. That makes sense. That's something that, should certainly be part of the package. But there also need to be estimates made in the case of premature closure, where a mine is closed in an orderly way, but well before the, predictions were in terms of how long the, mine would last. And then a third scenario is that situation where the mine shuts down suddenly without any closure or reclamation being done. I'm taking this straight from a, permit that was recently put together for the, Red Dog mine up in Alaska, where they did the estimates of the long-term water treatment needs. They did an estimate of the reclamation costs. They figured out what it would cost on an annual basis to deal with the long-term water treatment needs. And they went to their equivalent of their MMB, found out how much money would have to be deposited up front to put out enough money every year to pay for those water treatment costs, and that's the requirement that's in place. Minnesota can follow that same model. That will reduce the risk of uncertainty. But the basic concept, and the one thing that I want to make sure I get across, is that when there is a risk of uncertainty, when there is uncertainty about estimating costs, the risk has to be placed on the mining companies, not on the taxpayers. That's been the history. It's been the taxpayers in these states that have taken on the risk of uncertainty. That's something that has to be avoided in Minnesota. The other problem that has surfaced time and time again with respect to financial assurance in this mining industry is accepting the wrong forms of financial assurance. As Mr. Veda said, 20 years ago, the most common form of financial assurance was some kind of corporate guarantee, you know, a promise to pay. I'm gratified that the DNR doesn't even consider a promise by the mining company to pay as being anything, you know, close to what the financial assurance rules would require. But even external corporate guarantees have proven to not be worth a great deal. Let's take the Polymet situation. Polymet's financial backer is a Swiss company called Glencore International AG. They've lent Polymet a lot of money. They have a security interest in their assets. They have an agreement to market 100% of their product. They have the right to, acquire equity in the Polymet company at a determined, I think, $3 a share price. So it would make sense for the DNR to ask that Glencore or any other company that's guaranteeing, essentially providing the financial backing, provide a guarantee that they would pay if Polymet were to default on its obligations. Glencore is one of the world's largest commodity trading companies, but only 14 months ago, they came within an eyelash of defaulting on their bonds. Their credit rating was dropped to BBB-, which is the lowest investment grade that you can get. They essentially ran out of cash. So even a corporate guarantee from one of the largest commodity companies in the world does not provide you by itself the kind of insurance that you need in order to, guarantee that the taxpayers aren't going to be left holding the bag. So the alternative is that we hear about, we heard a lot about in a testimony earlier, are surety bonds. Surety bonds and irrevocable letters of credit. Mining regulators have turned to those kind of third-party guarantees as being an option for assuring that the public will be protected. Essentially, those are webs, kind of three-way webs of contracts where somebody like a mining company will pay a bank or an insurance company a fee, will put up some collateral in exchange for the promise that the bank or the insurance company will pay under certain stated conditions, which could be a default or it could be the presentation of a formal claim from, say, an agency like the DNR. Those sound great. But in practice, those instruments are nowhere near as ironclad as they initially appear. When banks and insurance companies get hit with a big claim, and the numbers are big with these kinds of mining operations, they look for a way out. And sometimes that includes a refusal to pay, based either on some perceived technical flaw in the formation of the original contracts, or the general allegation that's available in any contract case that the contract is void from the beginning because of fraud in the inducement, because some misrepresentation was the basis of forming the contract and therefore it's null and void. Or if there's a bankruptcy in the picture, what's happened several times is that either the debtor or other creditors have sought protection from the bankruptcy court to get an injunction to prevent payment on letters of credit or surety bonds, on the theory that if a payment goes out, the bank or the insurance company will make a new claim on the assets of the company, and that will defeat the interests of all the other creditors. So if you ask the question, would a surety bond or a letter of credit meet the standard that it would be immediately available to the DNR to pay for environmental cleanup? The answer is no. If you ask the question, is a surety bond or a letter of credit guaranteed to be immune from interference from the bankruptcy courts? The answer is no, they would not be. That's why the Minnesota Management Budget, when it's looking for forms that it will accept to secure the performance on state contracts, will accept only one thing. They will accept cash or cash equivalents. So, what is the answer to this? I think the answer is fairly straightforward, and what we think needs to happen is the DNR should use the authority it has under the current rules, and it should do the following. Number one, DNR should require that the financial backers, the ones who are going to, reap the rewards from these mines, guarantee that the mining company's obligations will be performed. The DNR should also insist on contemporary notice of any changes in the financial arrangements so that those guarantees can be kept up to date. Number two, the DNR should audit the financial records of the mining companies as part of their annual review each year, and they should assure that closure costs, both closure costs related to the environment, closure costs related to personnel, are being accrued. In other words, that the money is being kept in the within the company and not distributed. The money to cover environmental costs, to cover, say, health insurance and pension costs, are kept within the company and are not distributed to shareholders. Number three, require that the mining companies set up separate trust funds in advance to pay for long-term water treatment costs, and to do it before the mining operation commences. Use the models that are already in place and that are being with the U.S. Forest Service, with the Bureau of Land Reclamation, with the EPA's development of new financial assurance rules for estimating long-term water treatment costs. Use those, but require the money in a separate trust fund up front. Number four, as I said before, insist that the financial assurance be in the form of cash or cash equivalents. That's what MMB does. The DNR should accept nothing less. And finally, number five, make the process transparent. Do the analysis of financial assurance in the environmental impact statement, as the EPA already requires. Commit to giving the public notice of the annual review, an opportunity to comment, and an opportunity to contest those decisions if they are contrary to the law. Mr. Chairman, those are the changes that Representative Hausman's bill would have required, but those are still the standards that this committee should insist on under the current set of rules. The stakes are high here, and it is important to get this right. But we remain confident that our state agencies, along with this committee performing its oversight function, will take the necessary steps to protect both Minnesota's taxpayers and Minnesota's environment. Privatize the gains, socialize the costs is kind of a nifty business model, but frankly, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it cannot be the basis of sound public policy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Strand. And Mr. Tamman, if you could state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'm Bob Tamman from Sudan, Minnesota, an old mining town. My wife, Pat, and I are retirees. Pat taught in Ely for over 30 years. I'm a retired electrician. I've worked in several of the mines in my younger days, including Mintac, the largest taconite operation in North America. I'd like to support Mr. Strand's eloquent argument for financial assurance. We've seen the difficulties we've had over the years. I think reserve mining was mentioned. We have the Dunka pit waste piles still leaching heavy metals into Birch Lake near Ely. The LTV, now Polymet tailings pond, which is still leaking. The Canisteo pit over near Grand Rapids. The water level is going up. We have problems with water going into the basements in Bovee. So we have a history of problems with supervising our mining interest. And earlier we heard Mr. Lehman say that previous generations were not as sensitive as we are now to mining pollution. So I'd like to read you a quote from a previous generation. This was from Georgius Agricola. He said, "Further, when the ores are washed, the water which has been used poisons the brooks and streams and either destroys the fish or drives them away." That's from 1556. Over 450 years ago, professionals in the mining industry knew that the water from mining operations was toxic. The problem is they work in a competitive environment, and it's awful tempting to use our public waters to dilute their polluted waters. And Pat and I, living in Sudan, we see examples of this all the time. I can look out my kitchen window and I see the head frame of the Sudan mine. Now, that's the Sudan Underground Mine State Park. It's a great state park. Everybody should visit it. But 40 years after they quit mining, we're still getting polluted water out of that mine. The water that's pumped out of that mine has to be treated. We have Lake Vermilion, just a mile away from our house. Lake Vermilion is high in sulfates. And the reason it's high in sulfates is because it's downstream of Mintac's tailings pond. Mintac's tailings pond is leaking millions of gallons of polluted water into the Pike Sandy River, and they're using Lake Vermilion to dilute their polluted water. We go to the south of our house, 10 miles, the Embarrass River, a nice little river. Historically, that's been a highway for tribal people. They go north up the Embarrass River, portage across the Laurentian Divide, hop into the Pike River, and they'd be at Lake Vermilion. The Embarrass River is downstream of Polymet's leaking tailings pond. And I think it's important that we recognize that tailings pond is still leaking. Even with Minnesota's stringent regulations, that tailings pond is still leaking. And we heard testimony before a Senate committee that I believe Mr. Scipione said the product from their plant is like washed sand going out into that tailings pond. I worked in the mines. And you can do a word search on Polymet's EIS. There's no washed sand involved. The correct term is mining slimes. That ore is less than 1% precious metals. The rest, it's ground to the consistency of base powder. When it's mixed with water, it's not sandy, it's silty. It's slimy, it's mining slimes. That's why they got that term. And so we're still dealing with those problems. And typically when you discuss serious environmental problems with mining proponents, they have a one-word answer for your environmental concerns. They say jobs. And so being I worked at Mintac, I'd like to give you a few statistics. When I went to work at Mintac in 1969, my productivity, our productivity was 6,000 tons per employee per year. Now it's over 13,000 tons per employee per year. Productivity has more than doubled in my working lifetime. It only takes half as many employees to turn out the same amount of ore. the mining industry no longer hires enough people to sustain our communities. And Virginia is a fairly good example. Virginia is surrounded by operating taconite plants. Over the last 10 years, Virginia School District has been losing enrollment. And something else this board might find interesting, when I went to work at Mintac in 1969, I walked in the door, and there was not one woman working in that plant. Mining corporations do not hire women. And then the ladies took them to court and taught them a little sensitivity. And so in the 70s, the mine started hiring women. And of course, Pat says that pretty much explains why productivity doubled. But regardless, the trend is not changing. The mining companies are going to continue automating. We aren't going to have enough people to sustain our communities. And as we're making decisions about how to use Minnesota's resources, our wetlands, our rivers and streams, we need an explanation of why mining isn't working all that good. And I think the economic theory of the resource curse probably is one of the answers we should be examining. If you Google the resource curse, it'll tell you that's the economic theory that areas that depend on selling non-renewable resources for the health of their economies very seldom have healthy economies. And I think the Iron Range of Minnesota could be a poster child for the resource curse. And so when we talk about the need for financial assurance, it's obvious we need it so we don't have to spend our money on the cleanups. And it's also obvious that the state of Minnesota needs to diversify up north. I believe since 1993 we rebated around $190 million to the mining industry. I would maintain, rather than rebate to the mining industry, we ought to be channeling that money to our main streets, to the entrepreneurs, to the people that have the energy to create a new economy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tamman. And Representative Hausman.
And I believe we've used up our time, and so I'll just close with two quotes. One you have in front of you, I believe. And that is the one that cites the various states: Alaska, Arizona, California, Colorado, Idaho, Montana, Nevada, South Dakota, Utah, Washington. Just one of those, Nevada. The potential unfunded liability somewhere between $96 million and $480 million. And this is the quote. The total potentially unfunded reclamation bonding liability of all the western states presently exceeds $1 billion. At the same time, the financial failure of numerous mining companies has exposed shortcomings in both bond methods and bond amounts. American taxpayers are faced with paying for this significant liability from mines left unreclaimed, shifting the economic burden from the companies that profited from the mines and leaving environmental disasters behind for the public to clean up. That's one view of reality, and the one that I believe we're trying to prevent in this state. But here is the other, and I think hinted by our last speaker. There are beginning to be economic studies about states like northern Minnesota. And one of them has looked at environmental protection, population change, and economic development in the rural western United States. And here are other views of the future. Opponents of environmental protection claim that protected lands limit the growth of nearby communities by locking up potentially valuable natural resources and restricting mining, logging, and grazing. Others claim that extractive industries are no longer the backbone of rural economies. Instead, the presence of protected federal lands encourage growth by attracting tourists and new residents. Economic security no longer depends on exporting raw materials. Instead, the presence of natural amenities, pristine mountains, clean air, wildlife, and scenic vistas stimulate employment, income growth, and economic diversification by attracting tourists and their credit cards, small business owners and their employees, and retirees and their stock portfolios. I think this issue is often portrayed as a jobs issue. I think there is a more sophisticated discussion that needs to take place. One is the potential damage of the very thing that could lead to a healthier future in this state. Those are summary comments. We thank you for your time. This obviously is no longer a bill moving forward, unfortunately. But I believe this is just the start of the conversation in Minnesota and here at the legislature. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And we have a couple of questions. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Hausman, thank you for coming forward. As you know, I'm a co-author of your bill, and it brings up a number of important things that we're concerned about. I would recommend anybody that's wondering what the range looks like today, spend a little time driving around Virginia if you happen to get lost like I did this spring. If you want to get depressed, drive around the town of Virginia and see what it's been through and the number of businesses that are closed and storefronts that are empty. I was trying to find a Catholic church, and I think I found two that were closed. It was an interesting Sunday morning excursion, to say the least. But I have a couple questions. That's just a comment that I think we do need to find things to do up north there. And this is one thing I think that certainly has strong possibility and can be done in an environmentally safe way, and we want that, absolutely. Mr. Chair, I have a couple of questions specifically for Mr. Strand. You brought up a number of concerns, and I think for the most part I heard the DNR say that they're working on addressing them. But when I'm troubled, you talked about financial guarantee and that the only financial guarantee accepted by the state of Minnesota is cash or cash equivalent. Currently, are you aware of how MnDOT and the other agencies in the state of Minnesota use what's called performance and payment bonds?
Sure,
Mr. Strand.
Mr. Chairman, sure.
And thank
Representative
you,
McNamara.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Strand, do you consider them cash or cash equivalent?
Mr. Strand.
Mr. Chairman, if I might address that, what I was referring to was the general provision in Chapter 15, I think it's Section 15.73, which is the alternative to the 5% withhold that the state typically imposes on contracts generally. The alternative form that can be supplied to the state of Minnesota in lieu of having 5% of the cash withheld from the payments are a series of different forms, all of which are either cash or backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. That's what I was referring to when I made that comment about what MMB has decided to accept.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Strand, you may not know, but I think everybody around this table knows that I spent 30 years in the contracting business, working in public sector contracting, and certainly know that if MnDOT's going to build a $220 million bridge over the Mississippi River in Hastings, they're going to hire one of three design build contractors, and they're going to have them post what's called a payment and performance bond. It actually doubles the amount of protection, not only for payment but for performance for the $220 million. That's going to be backed by an independent bond company, and I'm not aware that there is records where those things have defaulted and the state of Minnesota has had to pay. Those are extremely successful in my 30 years. I've done a number of jobs where I've gone in and worked for the performance bond company when somebody else defaulted. But I'm not aware, it's very rare when it does happen, that the public entity is left holding the bag. Those are extremely strong, regulated by the industry. You can't write performance bonds if you don't have the wherewithal to back them up. And as soon as you don't have that wherewithal anyway, that's taken away. I think that's the kind of outside protection that we do want. I actually like that a lot more than just relying on the company or some of their money. I like the idea of hundreds or however many millions, hundreds of millions or whatever the protection is. Don't you think that that would be good kinds of protection for us to use here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, I absolutely agree with you that third-party guarantees of payment are superior to the company or its affiliates or its parent corporations providing the guarantee. I don't think there's any question that surety bonds, letters of credit, are superior to the kinds of corporate guarantees that mining regulators were accepting in the 1990s. I don't think there's any question about that. But what I do know from, you know, my experience working as a litigator for, you know, 25, 30 years now, is that there is a there are a lot of surety bond situations. There have been a number of bank letter of credit cases where the promptness of the payment has been, it's been very slow. What's happened is that the companies have insisted that the state, if it's a state agency involved, file suit to recover on the bond or file suit to recover on the letter of credit. When the need for the money is urgent, and that's what's different between a performance bond for transportation and having to clean up an environmental problem that might be urgent. What happens is when the need for the money is urgent and the surety company, the bank, or the insurance company decide that they're not going to pay promptly but are going to require the state to sue it out, all the negotiating leverage is on the surety company. The state and the state agency have to negotiate settlements for less than 100 cents on the dollar in order to get any money released so that they could perform their obligations. I wish I could say that the companies will always honor their commitments because they seem ironclad in terms of the contractual commitments. And I think the cases that have gone to the verdict have typically gone in favor of the state agencies that are involved in that litigation. But the problem is the time. The problem is the time that it takes to sue out on a bond, to sue out on a letter of credit, and be able to collect. And that's time that in this circumstance, in the circumstance where, say, a tailings basin needs immediate maintenance or something like that, is not something that I think the state can rely on completely.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Strand, I don't want to get into a back and forth, but you're on the right track that you want adequate financial assurance. The DNR has stood up here and said that's what they want.
Mm-hmm.
Mining companies that said that's what they're willing to do.
Mm-hmm.
We need to get this wrapped up and make sure that we are protecting our state and moving this forward. And I'm glad to hear you say you're not there to stop this no matter what. That, and I appreciate that. I think a good discussion about how strong is the surety bond company going to be. You and I philosophically looking at this, whether it's half full or half empty. My experience, I will tell you, Mr. Strand, is there is nothing that a contractor, or in this case, a mining company, is scared of more than their bond company calling them, telling them, get out on the job, get it fixed, or we're pulling the plug on your future being. And that's really, really strong. You live and die by that bonding company or whatever that outside interest, the bank or whoever it is holding it over your head. So, Representative Hausman, thank you for being here. Thank you for doing this. And, Mr. Strand, keep working on it, but we want this to go forward.
Mm-hmm.
This is drive around Virginia and look at what is there today, and this could help. We can do this in the right way and with adequate financial assurances.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, we've made it very clear to the DNR and the mining companies, we're ready to talk about this at any time.
Representative Virginius.
Thank you. I'm sensing this meeting is over, and I just want to announce that Environment Finance will meet here in 15 minutes after your gavel goes down.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hey, you bet. Any other questions? Okay. I would like to thank everyone who testified today and all those who participated. Been very informational, and certainly many of us are all looking for the same solution here, same objective, which is to make sure that the mines are being operated in a way that's safe for the environment and that our taxpayers aren't left holding the bag if there are problems that arise. With that, we do have to approve the minutes from the last meeting. It would be, what was the date on that? March 16th. And anybody like to move those minutes? Representative Sterner.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes last meeting.
Thank you. Representative Sterner moves the minutes from the last meeting. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted, and this meeting is adjourned.